Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Senate Democrats vowing to filibuster Judge Gorsuch after nomination hearings in which he said as little as possible while insisting he is fair and open-minded. We will discuss Gorsuch's most shocking ruling, which Senator Franken tried to question him on, and that is the case of the frozen truck driver, an appropriate subject on a day when Donald Trump had a photo opportunity with a bunch of truckers. Robert Fetter, a Labour lawyer whose client was Alphonse Madden, joins us to discuss how Gorsuch put corporate interests over the survival of a man freezing to death. We will look into how six of seven judges sided with Mr. Madden against Trans-Am Trucking, who fired him for unhitching his trailer with frozen brakes to seek warmth and fuel for his truck in minus 27 degree Arctic weather, as opposed to waiting for a repairman who was 3 hours late and freezing to death. But one judge sided with the company who fired Madden, which brought Neil Gorsuch to the attention of the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation and made him popular with the Chamber of Commerce, with all three promoting his Supreme Court candidacy for siding with business over regulation. Then we'll look into the extraordinary lengths that Devin Nunes, the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, went to in trying to give Donald Trump cover for his lie that Obama phone-tapped him and extricate Trump from an impasse since Trump refuses to apologize to Obama for calling him a bad or sick guy. James Bamford, an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues and author of The Shadow Factory: Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA, From 9/11 to Spying on America, joins us to discuss the need for an independent investigation and his article at Foreign Policy, the multi-billion dollar U.S. spy agency you haven't heard of. Then, with today's delay of the vote on the Trump-Ryan repeal of Obamacare, Trump's first piece of legislation now hanging by a thread, we'll examine what he has achieved so far. James Goodwin, a senior policy analyst with the Center for Progressive Reform, joins us to discuss Trump's successes so far via the Congressional Review Act, which includes allowing mentally ill people to buy guns, big oil to pay bribes, the dumping of mineral waste into headwaters, and the killing of bears and wolves in Alaska's wildlife refuges. And joining us now is Robert Fetter, who's a labor lawyer with Miller Cohen in Detroit, where his practice focuses on representing employees and their unions in disputes against their employers. He litigates cases in the state and federal courts and also litigates unfair labor practices before the National Labor Relations Board and the Michigan Employment Relations Commission. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Fetter.
Thanks for having me.
And a client of yours came up in the Neil Gorsuch hearings a couple of days ago, with Senator Al Franken being particularly frustrated with the nominee to replace Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, where it is pretty clear from what I understand about the case that in your client, Alphonse Madden, was that essentially Neil Gorsuch put corporate interests over your client, who was freezing to death and had to make a life or death decision to save his own life, but that for which he lost his job, and Gorsuch thought that the employer was right to fire him. Is that an accurate synopsis?
That is an accurate synopsis.
So what explains then that reasoning? It appears to be so heartless and even pointless.
Well, it's not just that. It's that Judge Gorsuch, in that particular case, now bear in mind that that case was decided in early August of 2006, so you have to go back to that time frame. That's in the middle of the presidential election. President Trump had issued a list of possible Supreme Court justices a few months before that, in which Gorsuch was not on the initial list. So it seemed as though that Gorsuch was attempting in this case, in this dissent. Now, my client still won, but Gorsuch wrote a dissent in which, throughout the course of his case, you have to remember that seven judges looked at this case, and six of them ruled in my client's favor. One of them did not, and that was Neil Gorsuch. He had to go to quite an extent to write a hyper-textualist argument to demonstrate just how dispassionate or discompassionate he could be and how textualist he could be in this decision. The logical fallacies in his argument to go that far to rule against my client were, in my opinion, quite extreme.
So let's talk about this case, which has come to be known as the case of the frozen trucker. What exactly happened? Can you give us a brief description of what was happening on that night when Alphonse Madden, who had a very impressive career but got downsized in the Great Recession and took a job driving a truck?
Hey, let me first comment on how it's referred to as the case of the frozen trucker, which my kids believe that is the title of a Scooby-Doo book. But what happened to him is there is a dispute with his employer over where he should get gas. They were giving him bad addresses. So he's running out of gas. So rather than continue to drive and wait for an address to go get gas, this happened so long ago, and this was through the courts for such a long period of time that this is before smartphones were really popular. So he pulled off on the side of the road to wait. It was this was in rural Illinois on I-88, and it was somewhere between 27 below zero, 20 below zero outside. Matter of fact, in the truck, inside the truck, the thermometer was reading minus 14 degrees. So this wasn't just cold. This was Arctic. This is one of the coldest days in Illinois history. In the middle of the night, he went to, after he got the appropriate address for the truck stop, he went to pull back out on the road, and the brakes on the trailer of the truck had froze. So he could not move the truck. Called for a repair person who he thought would come out shortly, within an hour. So he went and bundled up in the back of the cab. The bunk heater, the heater for the truck, which the heat off the engine doesn't work because a tractor trailer like that doesn't idle, or doesn't idle for very long. It broke. It doesn't work when it's that cold. So he woke up 3 hours later, and he found that he could not feel his feet. He describes it as not like when you're a kid playing out in the snow in Detroit and your feet get numb. It was as though he had a prosthetic feet. They just were no feeling whatsoever. The skin in his torso he describes as cracking and burning. He was having problems breathing. He woke from a phone call from his cousin, and his cousin could not understand what he was saying. He was slurring his speech, and he couldn't talk. Initially, he didn't understand why he was suffering from these conditions until he looked at the temperature in the truck, which was minus 14 degrees Fahrenheit. At that time, he called the dispatch, and they said, sit tight. He waited, and then he quickly realized that he was deteriorating quickly, and he was getting woozy. He thought he was going to pass out, and he said, I got to do something. So he realized that it's just the brakes on the trailer that are frozen. So he decided to disconnect the tractor from the trailer and go to seek safety. Before he did so, and his description of thinking that either he was going to have to amputate his feet or that he would die, because out there in those temperatures, once he got outside the truck, he didn't know whether he would fall. And if he fell, he believed he would certainly die because he would not be able to get back to his feet, and he was ready to pass out. And if he passed out, he was a goner. He was able to disconnect the trailer. Before he left, he called dispatch, and they ordered him not to leave that trailer. And they ordered him, if you're going to go, you have to drag that trailer with frozen brakes, which would be incredibly unsafe, not only for him, but other people that are driving in the middle of the night down that expressway. He decided neither of those were very good options, and the only real option that he had was to go to seek shelter, which he did. And as he was able to drive the truck, he started to have heat off of the engine. About a half hour later, he got a call that the mechanic had arrived. He went back to the truck, hooked it back up once the brakes were working, and finished the and delivered the load,
which was a load of frozen meat, wasn't it?
Yeah, right. It was a load of frozen meat.
Right.
And when he got back to the headquarters, he was fired.
And he was away from the rig, right? He'd unhitched for about, 30 minutes?
About 30 minutes.
Yeah, and in that time, the repairman showed up, 3 hours late?
Yes.
And the company, Trans Am Trucking, fired him for abandoning the rig, even though he was
freezing. For abandoning the cargo, the load.
Right, even though he was freezing to death. And was only absent for about 30 minutes, and even less than that because the repairman had arrived within that time frame, right?
That's right.
And so what happened then to the case? And it went through obviously went through layers, right?
Yeah, it went through multiple layers. This type of action doesn't go through a court per se. It goes through an administrative action. It starts with an employee filing a complaint with OSHA and the Department of Labor, which he filed on his own, and he sought attorneys, looking for attorneys that handle these sort of things. And there's just very few attorneys, even labor attorneys like myself, that handle these sort of things. But we at Miller Cohen, we actually handle a lot of these. So he got turned down by attorney after attorney, because attorneys nowadays are like doctors. We're all specialists. And I had a lot of compassion for what he went through and a lot of experience handling these administrative matters. So it ultimately went to a trial before an administrative law judge, in which he won. They appealed that to an administrative review board, which is kind of like an appellate court of a panel of three judges. He won that unanimously. All three judges went his way. The employer then appealed again to the Tenth Circuit Court, which got assigned a three-judge panel, which included Neil Gorsuch. And he won that case 2-1 with a dissent from Neil Gorsuch.
And when did Gorsuch make that ruling?
I believe it was August 6th of 2006.
I see. And the assumption is that somehow his dissent actually did him a favor in terms of being recruited by Trump. That's a conclusion others have come to. What's the basis for that?
The basis is because the Trump had kind of subcontracted the decision on judges to the Federalist Society and Heritage. And what they are looking for are judges that are going to be pro-business, that are going to be textualists, that will both render decisions correctly based on what they want as to cultural issues like abortion, and also be pro-business. In my opinion, his decision showed that he could be a textualist or an originalist when it comes to constitutional law, and that he would be that he would go out of his way to rule for business and show that he's pro-business. Now, I think that's had an effect. Many business interests have. The Chamber of Commerce and those type of people have labeled him as a great candidate because he will be pro-business. I believe being pro-business or pro-corporate is an acceptable philosophy for a legislator to run for election. And if you can get elected on that principle, that's fine. But for a judge, that is not a judicial philosophy. That, in my opinion, is merely bias. And a judge should be able to look at a case and its facts and apply the law without tilting the scales one way or the other. And I believe that in this case, Judge Gorsuch signaled that he is willing to tip those scales.
Well, one of the things that's been frustrating about all of these hearings, and this one was probably the most frustrating of all, because you never learned what was in Gorsuch's heart, you only learned what was in his head, and he virtually didn't answer any question. And you know, his predecessors, particularly Alito and Roberts, were never asked, are you a corporatist? I mean, we know, roughly speaking, the law is divided into kind of public interest law, criminal law, etc., and then a big chunk of practices are corporate practices. And so it's a reasonable way to look at the law in general and how it's practiced to ask a potential Supreme Court justice, you know, do you have a corporate bias? And if ever there was an example of somebody with a corporate bias, it's the case that we're talking about, the case of Alphonse Madden.
Yes, I believe so.
So what's wrong with the questions? I mean, I'm not saying that Al Franken didn't try, But why is it that that is not a part of it? You know, it's the focus is on abortion and other social issues, but never on that fundamental question about, you know, where do you come from in the law and what's your background and bias?
Well, I think it's important. Now, whether they'll give truthful answers as to whether they have bias or not, I would believe that a judge would be savvy enough, like Gorsuch, to indicate that he has no bias, that he's going to rule, you know, based on the facts of the case, and that's what he's going to say. But unfortunately, he has a record. And, you know, you ask him about cases such as Mr. Madden's case, and he says, you're just cherry-picking cases. Well, we wouldn't say that to a legislator. We wouldn't say, you know, you had a bad vote in this case, which I think indicates your point of view on something, and say you're just cherry-picking my votes. No, this is your record. This is what you did to signal to others of how you would be as a Supreme Court justice. And I think it's very meaningful, especially given the timing of this case, that it was decided at the time while a presidential primary was going on. So I think it's really something, and I do want to mention his tone at the hearing, if you don't mind, because I have a point of view on that.
Go ahead.
He has been very pleasant, very folksy. Some have described it. Now, I have very limited experience with Judge Gorsuch. I argued one case before him, and that was not my experience in any way. When I appeared before Judge Gorsuch, he was nothing but hostile. In fact, what brought that back to me in a very meaningful way is when I watched the questioning of Senator Franken to Judge Gorsuch. He, you know, Franken was hostile because he has a point of view. And that is exactly how I remember my argument before Judge Gorsuch. He was incredibly hostile. He was not folksy. I didn't get an shucks from him one time. You know, he was very hostile to my client's case and to my argument. And perhaps the most hostile judge I've ever appeared before.
And this, of course, is Gorsuch when he was nominated by Donald Trump. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce greeted that nomination and said the choice was fantastic. So, in other words, here we are talking about this case, which I find appalling. I think most of our listeners do. It's just an extraordinary situation where a man has to save his life and is punished for it by his employer and then later by Judge Gorsuch. It makes absolutely no sense to the layperson or to anybody with a modicum of compassion. And yet this is a calling card that somehow that's helped Gorsuch get the nomination. And that seems to be pouring salt into the wound. I don't understand that at all. But so can you just be the devil's advocate for a moment and try and tell us, what was Gorsuch's argument? Why did he dissent? What was the basis of his dissent? I understand it has something to do with the so-called Chevron rule, that the judges favoring Madden leaned towards the so-called Chevron doctrine. But clearly Gorsuch is challenging that. So two questions. One, what was Gorsuch thinking and how did he argue it and what was his justification for his ruling? And two, what is the context here of the Chevron doctrine?
Well, he primarily made a textualist argument and he focused on a portion of the statute. The statute in question here is the Service Transportation Assistance Act, the STAA. In that act, it has which is generally written to protect the health and safety of commercial truck drivers and the driving public. Within that, it allows a truck driver not to be fired for refusing to operate a vehicle in which he or she has reasonable apprehension of injury. So what he focused on was the refusal to operate. And what he said was that Mr. Madden didn't refuse to operate the vehicle. He actually operated it. And his employer was actually telling him not to operate it. Now, our argument and the argument that every other judge made, although there's some variation in different arguments, but on that precise issue, every other judge recognized that the trailer itself is recognized as a vehicle under just about every statute under federal law and most state laws. And what he refused to do was operate the defective vehicle, which his employer instructed him to drag. And he refused to do that. He refused to drag the truck or the trailer. So Judge Gorsuch ignored the word vehicle and focused on the word operate and said operate essentially means drive. And Mr. Madden did not refuse to drive. He actually drove. And even if that word is ambiguous, which the majority accused Judge Gorsuch of cherry-picking dictionary definitions and found its own dictionary definition of operate, which fits this scenario. But, you know, that's the primary textualist argument that he was making. Now, as to Chevron, based on this decision and other decisions, Judge Gorsuch has a distaste for Chevron, which is a Supreme Court case, which allows some deference towards the expertise of agency officials to make decisions regarding particular statutes when Congress gives them that authority. So here, the Department of Labor has consistently ruled on cases that are somewhat analogous to Mr. Madden's in the truck driver's favor or in the employee's favor, which ought to, and as they did in Mr. Madden's case, which under the Chevron standard should be giving some deference. Not only did Judge Gorsuch refuse to give that deference to the department, and that's a signal, again, to this pro-business thing, because it is a way to get kind of an anti-regulation type of philosophy that fits within the pro-business philosophy. So I think that's where this really fits in. But also, the other tough part of this, which I think that Judge Gorsuch really showed something, was if there is an ambiguity under the law, you are to look at sometimes the intent of the statute in total to help resolve that ambiguity. The focus of this statute is health and safety. There's no doubt about it. And he entirely dismissed health and safety of workers and the driving public. And matter of fact, he referred to health and safety as ephemeral. Now, what ephemeral means is fleeting or not long-lasting. It's not a long-lasting principle, or it's a fleeting objective. I don't know how any judge or any person can describe health and safety for workers and drive the driving public as ephemeral.
Well, just in closing, the Democrats plan to filibuster the Gorsuch nomination. At least Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer has indicated that he's vowed to lead an attempt to filibuster this nomination. Should this be the basis? I mean, there are other reasons. He's sitting in a stolen seat, etc. But from what you've told us here today, my sense is that this is an awfully important point. And if this guy gets to the Supreme Court, obviously... You know, he'll certainly overturn Chevron to begin with, but in general, I don't know where we find people like this. I mean, to Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch, are there a lot of people out there in the United States like these people who think the way that they do? I can't believe that we should have a majority on a court that thinks this way. They have to be a minority of Americans.
They're a minority of Americans, but they're probably the majority of those judges in the federal bench that are appointed by Republicans, probably a vast majority of them. But let me tell you what's at stake here for workers, because it's been the privilege of my life to represent workers. Middle-class kid myself, my father was a car mechanic, and I lived the American dream, got a degree, and now I do a job that I love, which is representing workers. We only have very few rights as workers in this country, probably some of the fewest rights as any industrialized country in the world. And what few rights that we enjoy, they are really at stake here, because the Supreme Court will interpret these rights. And somebody with the ideology like Gorsuch, who will be, who has signaled, based on recently being overturned by the Supreme Court, that he may be further right than any other Supreme Court justice that's currently sitting. And he will certainly side with Roberts and Alito and justices of that ilk to narrow and to restrict workers' rights. In fact, we really dodged a bullet when the public sector Friedrichs case came up, which would have made every public sector union member in the United States essentially right to work. And when Scalia passed away, that decision came out shortly thereafter. That was, Scalia had heard oral argument in that case and passed away before the decision was issued. That decision came out 4-4. There will be another case just like that that will come up after Gorsuch will be confirmed, and that is a primary example of what we're facing. Workers' rights will be severely limited if we continue to confirm judges who have the type of point of view and ideology as Judge Gorsuch. And that is what the Chamber of Commerce, that is what the pro-corporate interests want. They want fewer rights for individual workers.
Well, Robert Federer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Federer, who's a labor lawyer with Miller Cohen in Detroit, where his practice focuses on representing employees and their unions in disputes against their employers. He litigates cases in the state and federal courts and also litigates unfair labor practices before the National Labor Relations Board and the Michigan Employment Relations Commission. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the extraordinary lengths that Devin Nunes, the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, went to try and give Donald Trump cover for his lies about Obama.
Trucking, run together, more or less in line. Just keep trucking on, on.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Bamford, an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He's a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuses of American Intelligence Agencies, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. He also writes for Wired magazine and has an article at Foreign Policy, The Multi-Million Dollar U.S. Spy Agency You Haven't Heard Of. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Bamford.
Well, thank you, Ian. I appreciate it.
So before we get to the multi-billion dollar U.S. spy agency you haven't heard of, which is amazing to think that there's an agency bigger than the CIA and the NSA that nobody knows about, but let's talk a little bit about the disarray within the intelligence community, particularly in the oversight part. Now that Devin Nunes, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, who was on the Trump transition team, went to the White House, which is a target of an investigation. The FBI director just the other day said that they're investigating the Trump campaign and Trump himself, and also went on to say that Trump was effectively a liar vis-a-vis his charges about Obama wiretapping him. But nevertheless, Nunes goes over there and presents the president with some so-called intelligence, and nobody knows where it came from. And then Trump now feels he's vindicated, because obviously Trump does not want to apologize to Obama, who he called a bad and sick guy, and somehow feels whatever he was given is sufficient to get him off the hook. And now, of course, Nunes's colleagues are furious with him, and it looks as if at least the House Intelligence Committee is completely dysfunctional. So is it? Do you think it's broken beyond repair?
Well, Well, I think it's been compromised beyond repair because you have the chairman of the committee going and briefing the person who is pretty much one of the key suspects being looked at, the President of the United States, President Trump, without ever telling other members of the committee, especially his ranking member, the top Democrat on the committee. So it certainly looks like the chairman of the committee is more interested in providing cover for the president, who is under suspicion, rather than conducting a fair and open hearing.
So is it, there's, of course, the ranking member, Adam Schiff, is calling for an independent investigation, as is a number of other senators, and including John McCain, for example. But do you think that Nunes did this, you know, obviously he did it to help Trump or give Trump cover, but did he also do it to sort of kill the hearing itself and rip the committee apart? I mean, is there some method to his madness?
Well, from what I hear, he was extremely angry when he read whatever it was he was given, those documents from some kind of a source or whatever. And his anger got the best of him. So he just, even though other of his aides and other associates told him he shouldn't do it, he just got up and basically got over to the White House as fast as he could and briefed the president. And then held a press conference before and a press conference after. And all that shocked, I think, many of the members, not only on the Democratic side, you know, especially Adam Schiff, who was supposed to be sort of his co-equal on the committee, but even members of the Republican side, so much so that Devin Nunes had to actually come out and apologize today. It just shows that there's not really any way that this could be done fairly by people who are more interested in protecting the president than finding out what was really going on.
But what could that material be? Because this White House has been signaling for some time that they feel that incidental collection, which is what they call it, from, you know, when, say, the NSA or the FBI targets a foreign actor, and then they contact an American, that American is usually, you know, redacted unless there's some suspicion. And in this case, they've been signaling all along that all the problems they have, in other words, to justify Trump's outrageous claim that Obama spied on him, they're going to present some evidence of incidental collection that in itself doesn't prove anything, but at least it sort of muddies the water little enough for Trump supporters to believe that he's been exonerated. So what's the status of this report that allegedly made Devin Nunes so angry? I mean, who's got it apart from Trump?
Well, there's been very little information let out, so it's very difficult to say. But since it's incidental collection, it could be one of several things. For example, Mike Flynn, the general who was the short-term national security advisor, General Mike Flynn, was picked up on an incidental wiretap of basically the a tap that was targeting the ambassador from Russia to the United States. So they weren't tapping Trump and they weren't tapping Flynn, but they were tapping the Russian ambassador, who's probably been tapped for the last 50 years. Everything going in and out of the Russian embassy is listened to by the FBI. So he was picked up in that, and then at some point, apparently somebody revealed his name, because when a report is made, if the FBI picks it up internally or the NSA picks it up externally, what they do is they put instead of putting the American person's name, they just put down U.S. person. And then somebody has to say, well, who is this U.S. person? And then the NSA or the FBI reveals the name of that person. And that's what apparently happened. And in the case of Flynn, his name was revealed. So I think that's what he was talking about. He was talking about being concerned that there were names that may have been revealed in some of this communications that was picked up by targeting other individuals, either Russian. What he says is it didn't involve the Russians at all, which makes it very curious who they were targeting then, since they probably weren't targeting American allies like the British. And it makes you wonder who they were targeting, who are NSA or FBI targets, people that they feel that they should be knowing what they're saying. And here it is, you know, people from the Trump campaign that are talking to them. So it's very mysterious, and what it seems to be coming down to is that there's a link between the campaign and the Russians who may have been involved in releasing the emails during the campaign.
And that's the story that CNN has just broken, right? That, I mean, there's been a lot of breaking news. And, of course, the AP broke the story yesterday that Manafort had signed a $10 million a year contract with a Russian oligarch close to Putin to make Russia look good. So,
but also today, from what I understand, Adam Schiff, the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, came out and made a comment indicating that he felt that there was probably enough evidence for this to go to a grand jury, if that was what was going to happen. In other words, that there's more than just smoke there. There's enough evidence to take it to a grand jury if this was going to be a criminal investigation. If the Justice Department decided on pursuing this, there would be enough at this point to go to a grand jury. So I think that, again, pushes the ball further down the path, even further than it was last Monday when he testified before Congress. Even the FBI director testified before Congress.
Well, a lot of people who are defending the idea that this is, you know, a kind of form of McCarthyism and et cetera, and I've certainly got a lot of mail along that direction just for simply trying to figure out what's going on here, because it does seem to be an important story. And if all 17 intelligence agencies release a report saying that the Russians hacked the election and it was done at the behest of Putin and it was done to help elect Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton, to me that's an extraordinary situation and worthy of investigating further. So, and of course the Russians keep saying, and RT, the Russian outlet, keeps saying, where's the proof, where's the proof? It does seem, I mean, there's no proof because it's an investigation. They're not going to throw all their cards on the table before they've built a case. But how does it look to you? Because I know you've been skeptical of you know, too much sort of unsupported charges so far. But where does it strike you now that Comey and Rogers have come forth and basically said the president lied and he's the subject of an FBI investigation?
Well, I was also skeptical, especially at the very beginning, because there were a lot of charges coming out without any substance. And there still are a lot of questions. There was all this mingling of detail about hacking. I don't think there's any question that the Russians hacked the DNC. They probably hacked. A lot of elections. We hacked the Mexican election, according to documents from Snowden's archive. I wrote an article about how we tapped into the last Mexican election, planted malware in their system, and extracted 85,000 text messages. So I don't doubt that the Russians tapped into the DNC. The issue is, were they the ones who actually released the emails? And there was a lot, the evidence pointing to that was a lot less convincing, especially the evidence linking that Glucifer II, who was supposed to be the person who passed the information on to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. There was a lot of, that was far less convincing to me than just the fact that the Russians hacked the DNC. So I was skeptical at first, and it seems more solid now because you have the director of the FBI coming out and saying that there's substance to it, that they've been investigating this since last July. And some of the other leaks that have been coming out now are far more pointed towards actual detail as opposed to just speculation.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, James Baffert, let's turn to your article in Foreign Policy, the multi-billion-dollar U.S. spy agency you haven't heard of, and that, of course, is the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. And you begin the article by pointing out that Barack Obama was visiting a hamburger joint in 2009, and he asked a customer seated at the table about his job, and what do you do, the president asked, and he said, I work for NGA. And the man answered, and Obama didn't know what that was. So, and we don't know what this is, and maybe Trump doesn't know what the NGA is. So tell us, what is the NGA, and why is it the biggest intelligence agency we haven't heard of?
Well, it's actually been around for a while. The problem is it hasn't been involved in any scandals like the CIA and the NSA. And also the work it does is largely areas that are not very controversial as opposed to the CIA that sends agents around and the human spying and the NSA, which eavesdrops on people. The NGA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, whose headquarters is actually larger than the U.S. Capitol building, larger than the CIA. It's the third largest building in the entire Washington area. It's a huge facility. And they just built a new $1.7 billion building. They're just in the process of building one now, a new building in St. Louis. It's going to have thousands more people in it. But its job is to look down on the Earth from satellites and from drones. So it is to pictures what NSA is to voices. And that's really a big thing now. It's the collecting imagery from the sky over the Middle East. And the problem now is that some of that hardware, some of those drones that are being used to spy on much of the Middle East, will now are beginning to come back to the United States. And some of that's being turned over to law enforcement. And something that is extremely sophisticated. They have one drone, for example, it's called Argus IS. It's the world's highest resolution camera, 1.8 billion pixels. And all you need really is two of those, and you can look at everything that's going on constantly over Manhattan, 24 hours a day, and see something as small as a stick of butter on a plate or follow somebody walking to a park or follow a car going over a highway. So these are things that are in the future. And the problem is we've never established any kind of laws or statutes. We put a number of statutes on the book to prevent illegal or unethical or improper eavesdropping on American citizens, but there's absolutely nothing on the books to prevent using these militarized drones, these drones designed for wars, to be used domestically. And the problem is with President Trump, that's one of his focuses, is this heavy emphasis on domestic security. So would he use those to, follow Muslims coming out of a mosque, or use those to peer down on American citizens in larger locations and so forth. So those are the issues that really need to be dealt with by Congress before the actual hardware starts filtering back U.S. law enforcement organizations.
Well, James Baffert, you've given us a lot to think about. I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Ian. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with James Baffert, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He's a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine and the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. He also writes for Wired magazine and has an article at Foreign Policy, the multi-billion-dollar U.S. spy agency you haven't heard of. We're going to take a brief station break, and with Trump's first piece of legislation now hanging by a thread, We'll examine what he has achieved so far.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Goodwin, who's a senior policy analyst with the Center for Progressive Reform, who has published articles on human rights and environmental law and policy, appearing in the Michigan Journal of Public Affairs and the New England Law Review. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Goodwin.
Thank you for having me.
And James, obviously with the possibility that the House may not pass this Ryan Care bill that Donald Trump has gone to the Hill to chastise Republicans and sort of whip them into shape, even threatening them. So to that extent, he's put his so-called reputation on the line. If it doesn't pass, and we know it's even more uphill in the Senate, would that mean that essentially everything that he's done, Trump so far, has pretty much come to nothing? We know that his executive orders on the Muslim ban have backfired on him twice. They've been rejected by the courts. And if his first piece of legislation in the House doesn't even get to first base, that's going to look pretty bad. And basically, from what I understand from the work that you've been doing, is that the only things that Trump has achieved so far is that through these CRA resolutions that have already been signed into law, he's repealed protection that would have stopped big oil companies from bribing governments. It would have protected our streams from mining companies dumping toxic waste. And then it would have kept firearms out of the hands of individuals with severe mental disabilities. So far, is that the Trump legacy?
There's not a whole lot he can point to beyond those handful of accomplishments. That's not to say that they're not having a significant impact. I mean, these are endangering public health and safety and the environment, and they're big favors for the corporate donors for the Republican Party.
So explain then, if you would, for our audience, why it is or how it is that the Congressional Review Act gives the president this ability with the stroke of a pen to upend these important achievements.
Sure. So I think the important thing to keep in mind when thinking about the Congressional Review Act is it doesn't give Congress or the president powers that they don't already have. Congress and the president could pass legislation getting rid of existing regulations anytime they want. What the Congressional Review Act does is it temporarily suspends or eliminates some of the self-imposed procedures that the House and Senate have imposed on themselves that makes legislation harder to pass. But it applies in very narrow circumstances. It applies to these things that are called resolutions of disapproval for certain rules that have recently been finalized, and they expire after a certain period of time. And so what it does is it basically greases the skids so that these special forms of legislation can zoom through the House and Senate, particularly the Senate, and then reach the president's desk.
Well, aren't there even worse things to come? I mean, the three that I mentioned, which are the achievements so far, are pretty hideous. Letting big oil companies bribe foreign governments, allowing mining companies to dump toxic waste into the streams and waterways and headwaters, and then keeping firearms out of the hands of individuals with severe mental disabilities. But my understanding is that there's worse to come. The Fair Play and Safe Workplace executive order, the Department of Labor's unemployment compensation drug testing rules.
Sure.
That's also, I think they're doing that in the Health Care Act. Wasn't that one of the compromises to placate the Tea Party activists that now people on Medicaid have to prove that they are looking for jobs. I mean, this idea of punishing the poor is so mendacious, but it's clearly a big part of right-wing Republican ideology, and they somehow get a thrill out of it.
Sure, sure. So you've mentioned the three that have already passed the House and Senate and been signed by the president. If I have the numbers correctly, the Senate has just passed the fifth one yesterday. And that's to say that there are five more pending or waiting for the president's signature. I have a sixth one teed up today for a vote. I don't think that has taken place yet. But these hit issues of great public import across the board, as you mentioned, they address things like educational standards and how well we educate students across the country. They deal with ensuring safer workplaces for employees who work for federal contractors and those sorts of things. The unemployment drug testing, you name it. A lot of these are, like I said, big favors to corporate donors. And some of these are just classic identity politics. So things like the background checks under the Social Security process for evaluating people with mental disabilities, you know, that's, they get the point that that is a big win for the Second Amendment, when in reality, this is a rule that was passed in response to the Virginia Tech catastrophe. And these sorts of things are meant to prevent those sorts of events in the future. And without them, when we see the next unfortunate gun violence event like that, you can point to this vote and say, would this rule have prevented that?
Well, as you point out, that it was brought in after the Virginia Tech massacre, but it was also stripped out just recently at the behest of the NRA. Obviously, they're the lobby behind it. When you say these are payoffs to corporate interests and also powerful lobbies. Again, James Goodwin, a senior policy analyst at the Center for Progressive Reform. He's published articles on human rights and environmental law and policy appearing in the Michigan Journal of Public Affairs and the New England Law Review. So, but let's just go through. We talked about the first three that are the so far the main achievements of Trump's administration so far, these rule changes through the Congressional Review Act. You mentioned that there are five, there's two more that are passed, and there's a couple more, and there's one that's going through today. So can you give us the specifics on what these are going to be doing and what they'll be undoing? Because everything we're talking about is undoing something that is in there to protect the American people, either from gun violence or from pollution or from corruption. So can you just briefly run through what these other two are and what the others before the Senate are, one of which is going to be passed today?
Sure. So a recently passed one was a measure aimed at improving the standards for workplace health and safety and fairer wages for federal contractors. The idea being that if the government is going to do business with a contractor, then they should be held to the highest laws that apply to worker protections. This was issued in response to a series of government accountability office reports finding that this was not happening. So here you have, you know, the government's own auditors telling the federal government to address this problem. They issue this rule to do so, and then Congress steps in with very little oversight or investigation, because that's essentially what happens with the Congressional Review Act. It's essentially shooting from the hip, and they just pass this resolution, and it's gone. Another one would be Alaska's Predator Control Rule. This is on National Wildlife Refuges in Alaska. This federal land, the Fish and Wildlife Service, issued this rule to essentially restrict the most inhumane practices for predator control, and now that's gone.
Well, when you say that, but those rules are there to protect the indiscriminate shooting of bears and wolves and other, you know, iconic American animals on federal public lands. Isn't that what we're talking about?
Sure. I mean, these kinds of practices that would be banned, would have been banned under the rule had it not been torpedoed under the CRA, shocks the conscience for most people. And you have to say it runs against the values that undergird our public lands laws.
But what seems to be happening here at the broadest level is that the Republicans are moving as quickly as possible. The Trump administration and the House and Senate are moving as quickly as possible to undo these protections that protect our wildlife, our web users on the internet, American workers and the safety of our streets from gun massacres like what happened, you know, what's happened on a pretty regular basis. All of this is happening in this rush to repeal these rules. And it seems as though it's all happening when the press is too distracted from the daily insanity of the Donald Trump antics. And it's almost now, when I look through this list of stuff that they're doing and what they've done, and that these are the only achievements, again, I have to repeat this, the only achievements of the Trump administration so far, these are all hideous. And I think they're largely getting away with it because the public and the press aren't noticing. What's your thoughts?
I tend to agree with you. I mean, right now we have a Supreme Court justice or a nominee undergoing confirmation hearings. I'm old enough to remember to know when that would have dominated the press. Is that even above the fold right now with all the scandals going on? I mean, this sort of thing ends up being tertiary news at best.
So what can our listeners do? I understand that you've put together a website, is it, that they can visit to find out exactly what's happening under the Congressional Review Act with all these rules being eviscerated at the behest of big, powerful corporations and lobbies like the NRA?
Correct. Yeah, so my organization, the Center for Progressive Reform, is keeping a chart that keeps tabs on the resolutions of disapproval that have been introduced and their progress through the legislative process. A coalition I work with, the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards, has put together another website called Rules at Risk that provides an additional chart of that information, as well as additional details about the specific rules that are being targeted. So I would encourage your listeners to check out both sites, learn a little more about what the Congressional Review Act is, why it's bad policy in the broadest sense, because what we're essentially talking about is members of Congress with very little knowledge of the rules that they're targeting, getting rid of them. And something we haven't talked about yet is one of the big problems about the Congressional Review Act is once a rule has been torpedoed, the agency cannot issue another one that is substantially the same form without specific legislative authority from Congress. So not only do these things blow up this specific rule, it effectively ties the agency's hands going forward to address something similar. So in the case of the stream protection rule we're talking about, the rule to prevent headwaters from mountaintop removal mining, the Department of Interior is not going to have a lot of options for addressing that particular environmental and public health risk going forward unless Congress passes a law letting them do that. But I don't see that happening anytime soon. So these are the sorts of things you can learn about on these websites. And you can also see the specific rules that are being targeted, the harms that would result from these rules being repealed, and frankly, who stands to benefit from them, the particular industrial sectors that are championing it, and how much money they have spent lobbying against these rules.
And again, the website is rulesatrisk.org. That's rulesatrisk.org. I thank you for joining us, James Goodwin.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Goodwin, who's a senior policy analyst with the Center for Progressive Reform. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side, sign up for iTunes podcasts, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.